Hello and welcome to the Let's Talk Bipolar podcast, hosted by Emma Bell and brought to you by Bipolar UK. You can find all of our resources at www.bipolaruk.org. Welcome to this episode of Let's Talk Bipolar for Bipolar UK. And this week, my guest is Lauren Ely. And Lauren is a mental health advocate with a particular interest in support and education in the workplace settings. She's actually gone on to do many projects within this area, which I will get her to tell you all about in her own words. So without further ado, Lauren, welcome to the show. How are you today?
I'm great today. Thank you for asking. How are you doing, Emma?
All right. Well, the weather's beautiful here in Dubai, so I cannot complain. I'm very happy today. and today's a good day. So we take the good days, right?
100%.
So Lauren, could you tell us a little bit about, actually, let's start with you. So bipolar. You live with bipolar and you have a diagnosis of bipolar 1. So could you tell us in your own words how you came to know that you had bipolar and how you arrived at your diagnosis of bipolar 1, and just tell us a little bit about this for you.
Sure. So I was diagnosed in 2012. I was age 29. I had a major acute manic episode with psychosis. So it was very scary for me and everyone involved. I ended up being taken to an A&E and then sort of seen by an on-call psych team. And I was really, really extreme, and they were on the cusp of potentially admitting me to a psych ward, but my partner decided that he wanted to try and have home treatment team come and him help support me in the home, which I'm really grateful to, because it was, I think it would have been much more distressing being in the alternative setting. And through that episode, I was diagnosed with bipolar disorder. And it was an interesting one, because I know that it's typical for 10 plus years for people to be misdiagnosed and not get the correct, you know, support and help. And I don't really feel like I had much beforehand. So I do feel like it was a moment in time and they caught it and they documented it, and it was so extreme. You know, I know people that might have hypermanic episodes, mm-hmm. you know, they might go undiagnosed, but my manic episode was so extreme it had to be seen and addressed. And since then I've had two major manic episodes, mm-hmm. and there was sort of 7 years in between them. And I was relatively stable, although I sort of had a couple of sort of depressive, what I call blips, because they weren't really episodes. It was kind of building into something, but I recognized it wasn't right and something was wrong. So I would seek help and get it addressed. But for mania, I can never really see coming, because mm-hmm. the symptoms, particularly of hypermania, are very similar to my own personality. So being very productive, like that's just normal for me. Mm-hmm. And, you know, high energy, jumping from topic to topic, being very, you know, enthusiastic and wanting to see people and, you know, do a lot of things, kind of like the happy puppy, right? Mm-hmm. So it's quite hard. And so I think I was ignorant for a long time that even though they gave me this lifelong diagnosis, I really struggled with that, because I was like, what if I never have anything again? It could have just been a one-off psychotic episode. And I think I was quite naive in thinking that I would never have one again. Mm. So my second episode really taught me quite a lot.
Oh, gosh. So can we go back a bit, and can you tell me a bit more about your first episode, your first manic episode that led to this diagnosis, that from what you've said was very quick and very it was very quickly diagnosed, you know, could you tell me a bit more about that experience? Because it is different to hypermania, in as much as hypermania, like you say, can go unrecognized, undiagnosed, seen as societal, acing it, right? And so therefore it can go missed. And when it slips into mania, that's when people around us go, there's something wrong. So can you tell us what you're comfortable to tell us, what that looked like for you and how it was, you know, absolutely recognizable as not being well?
Sure. So I think, you know, you do a lot of reflection, right, and kind of look back on the episodes and try and spot the triggers, you know, like obviously learning your triggers and your stress points and what leads to things is a huge thing. I think the hypermania had probably been building for a while, but again, didn't recognize it as anything untoward. I was in a new job. I was about 6 months in. I was learning. I'd gone from working on one brand to working on over 100 and working on a really complex campaign for a client, which incorporated working with our competitor. So there was a lot of like challenges and stress involved with that. I then got run down and had the flu for about a week. And I should have taken another week off just to rest and recuperate. But this was pre-COVID when you just soldier on through. So the minute I felt well enough to like get into work, I went back too soon. And I was burning the candle at both ends. I wanted to have a social life as well as work my ass off. I was doing ridiculous hours at the time, and it was very, very stressful conditions. So I would go to a friend's birthday and say, I'll stay for one and be there till midnight, you know, with five or six cocktails in, and then getting up at six to be back at work to do, you know, all the hard yards over again. So there was this real like seismic combination of stress with work, physically unwell because I hadn't recovered properly from the flu, and then this wanting to do everything. And
how long would you say on reflection, because I know it can only be on reflection, but how long would you say now looking back that hypermanic build-up lasted for?
Definitely a few weeks, possibly a couple of months. It's really hard to know where the start line is, because it's a culmination of small things that then start to add together, isn't it? Like it's drinking coffee and adding alcohol and not sleeping. And I think in that kind of final like 3 days, I have a very vivid recollection of exactly what happened at what time. I definitely was getting home at 10 p.m. after work and going to sleep, but then not sleeping and really tossing and turning and thinking about stuff, and then getting up early and doing client meetings. And I think it culminated. I went to I had what felt like an epiphany at 10 o'clock one night. I'd finished work really late, but I was about to go into a major presentation to the client the next morning. I had this epiphany, and I looked back on this email I'd written. It was a massive, like, this is what we need to do to the people in the business. But I'd put my name against everything because I felt like it was my responsibility, rather than saying, these are the things the business needs to do in order to win this. It was, I'll do that, I'll do that, I'll do that, I'll do that. And like this kind of more and more pressure building on. And I didn't sleep that night because I got home and I had a brand new notebook and I wrote in it. And I don't know if the writing thing comes to you or your guests when you're manic, but I wrote an entire A4 workbook with not thoughts that were in my head. I can't throw it away, but I also can't read it because it's actually quite scary. You know, like it's like lines and repeating things and like swirls, and like I wrote an entire notebook. And then that night I didn't sleep because I was paranoid that if I slept I'd forget my epiphany that I needed to get a better work-life balance. So I was emailing myself under the covers so that I didn't wake my partner. And then the next day I went to this client meeting. It was 3 hours long. I scribed the entire thing. I wrote 27 pages of notes, trying to write down everything everyone said. Went back to work and I was talking so fast that they could barely follow what I was saying. But I didn't notice anything different. I was like, we've got so much to do. We've got to get this stuff done. Again, stayed late and then kind of crashed and burned, got home. Yeah, I mean, it kind of escalated. I mean, just so that you got the comparison between like proper mania and sort of hypermania, I was stripping myself naked in the lounge, trying to get my partner's attention, even though we had a housemate at the time that could have walked in at any time, was up all night, you know, was really like out of my mind. Like the things that I was believing was that there was a film crew about to knock on my front door and take me to the stage to perform with Dizzy Rascal in Hyde Park. And it was like the culmination of my work and the things I was doing was going into my brain, but I wasn't. I always describe mania to my mum as having, you know, your normal brain might have 10 red dots in it. So one's family, one's friends, one's your hobby, one's work. Not all of them connect and not all of them should connect. Like your best mates don't need to meet your boss or, you know, your uncle or whatever, right? So like these things don't meet. But I feel like mania is a million red dots in your brain and they're all interconnected. So when you start thinking about something, like the whole unorganized, disorganized thinking, you start to, someone might say, what's the weather like today? I'll be like, it was like this, but in 1729 it was this. And then, you know, like you're jumping all over the place. And so it's just, it was, yeah, that's kind of how I sort of explained to mum. But it was this real you know, extreme behavior. And my fiance, my now fiance, was really terrified. So he rang my GP in the morning and they were like, we've got nothing on record, take her to the A&E. If you come in to see us, it'll be months before she's seen. And I was so extreme and haven't had sleep for like 3 days that I needed to be like medicated immediately. So that was, and I was in the A&E and we were joined the back of the queue and I kind of had this toddler tantrum on the floor. So people were like, you go straight to the front. And then they were like, we'll put you in a room so that you're not, you know, you're kind of private while you wait for the psych team to come. And I was like creeping around while they were talking to my partner. It was, I was expecting another film. I was expecting when my partner put them in a cab to go to the hospital, I was thinking we were off to Heathrow to visit my mum, who was, you know, in my head, she was coming over from New Zealand to come visit me. And it's just, it was so extreme. And that's where the sort of psychosis comes into it, because it's believing things that aren't real, or believing things that other people don't understand or believe either.
So which parts for you do you remember? And actually they're your memories. And were there any parts that you just didn't remember and you were told?
I actually recently requested all my notes from all the years that I've been in services. And I started reading back through them and they're redacted with other people in them. So like they don't reference my partner's names and stuff. So like through GDPR, but it was more, I remember all the lead up. But I think once I started being medicated, I kind of have memory gaps. I was on, like, they put me on like a cocktail. I was on everything to just bring me down and stop me and sleep and try and start. Sleep was the biggest thing.
Yeah. Just in it to stop.
Exactly. So there's things that they quote that I said when they came to visit me on a daily basis that I have no recollection of that are unusual and not normal, but not kind of standard conversation. So it's, and I've sort of had to sort of stop reading that. Like it's quite distressing to kind of be like, I knew I was bad, but Jesus.
Yeah. Do you know, it's really interesting you say that. I was literally at an event last night talking with a lady who lives with bipolar, and we were talking about that, this little piece here, which actually isn't little, that as you come out of being very unwell, it's like you're aware that you've not been well, but as you get more stable, the realization of just how bad things were kind of comes in waves. And it's kind of like, oh my gosh, it's like another wave of realization of, wow, that's how, you know, how vast this was, this being unwell. And it's as you, for me and the lady that were talking yesterday, we were saying it's as you come out of it, it sort of hits you, and it keeps hitting you in little waves as you get more stable and out of that space. And it can kick up so much, right? As you're talking, I can see your face, like you're telling me, but it's like, oh, you know, and then I'm reading it, and then actually sad and pain, like the things I can see in your facial expressions is sort of this, oh my God, look, and then a look of, and actually that's really sad, and actually that's really painful, and actually that's really distressing, and you know, it's so much that realization brings up.
100%. Yeah. And actually it's really interesting recounting my first episode, because it was so out of the blue and so we had no idea. And then after the diagnosis and kind of having a few sort of blips, as I call them, kind of like moments where I kind of need to seek help, because I tried to go off medication. I didn't really want to be on it for life. I've now decided that's the right decision for me, but I had kind of moments on and off different drugs. And the second episode, again, I didn't see coming until I had this light bulb moment, and it was kind of too late. That was, again, probably months in the build up with, and this time it wasn't work related. It was more big major life decisions and seeing a lot of people. So I'm originally from New Zealand, and I had a lot of visitors that in those months beforehand where they'd come over and they were on holiday and we all had a great time. But I was, again, pushing the social boundaries, being out more than I should, mm-hmm. doing stuff on days of the week that I probably would normally rest. Mm-hmm. And then it culminated. I was on a holiday in summer, and I had the flu again, which then led into a chest infection, and I was coughing every few seconds. So I was awake for a couple of days. So for me, it's that real, like, sleep is the number
massive.
Absolutely. And like, I see people post around, you know, with children and not being able to sleep for days on end, and I'm like, that would actually send me mad. I couldn't, mm-hmm. I couldn't do that.
mm-hmm. Sleep is massive trigger, isn't it? Huge. Just huge.
And in that second episode, I was kind of aware, whereas the first one I kind of wasn't. I didn't know what was going on. Mm-hmm. I was kind of aware, but I couldn't stop myself doing the stuff I know wasn't helpful or mm-hmm. normal. So, not, you know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. I couldn't help.
Don't worry. Don't worry. I don't believe normal exists anyway. But
no, neither do I. So, my normal.
But I know what you mean. I know what you mean.
It was like, you know, like I was very in my head. You know, I knew that I needed sleep, but for some reason I would psych myself up before sleep and then not be able to sleep. And I just, it, like, very contradictory, even though I knew it was good for me, for some reason I was terrified of sleeping again. And I think you don't really think, it was kind of like having a mini bird's eye view, watching you make the wrong decisions and be kind of mindful of what you're going through at the same time. And I think for me, it was almost as scary as actually having psychosis. So it's kind of, it was the shame. And I know you've talked about that a lot on your podcast with other guests, you know, the shame and the guilt and the embarrassment is really hard to shift. And that's why I had such a longer recovery on that one, because I wanted to make sure I was right before I re-entered the workplace.
So let's talk about that a bit. So you had this manic episode and then got better. And then had 7 years before your next manic episode. And in that time, in your own words, you say you had two sort of depressive blips. Now, you've shared with me before we started recording that your experience is mostly based on the mania side of bipolar. And I think you're our first guest actually to speak to that in this way. So for you, when you say it was like a depressive blip, what did that look like for you?
So that looked like crying 2 or 3 times a day, really, like, the tears needed to flow. Like, I'd be walking to the train station after work across, like, you know, Waterloo Bridge with tears streaming down my face and feeling this kind of sadness or like weirdness and not knowing why am I crying? I don't understand this. Mm-hmm. When that happened for kind of a week or more, I was like, okay, this is not normal. And actually, maybe I am becoming unwell and going low. So maybe I need to get seen. And that was also at a time where I wasn't on medication. So for me, it felt like go on a really low dose of what I was on before, just to kind of nip it in the bud. And that did help. And then it sort of another one happened maybe a year later. Mm-hmm. And again, the medication just got upped. For me, it was just more, but because it was so out of character for me versus the kind of the boisterous and the energy and the productivity that comes with my personality, but also my illness, it's harder to spot where the line gets drawn there. So for the depressive blips, I feel like it was an easier spot. Mm-hmm. And I do think it's in the family. My paternal grandfather had mania only and had a major, major episode and was retired early and was on lithium for life. Mm-hmm. And then my maternal grandfather died by suicide many years before I was born. And it's uncertain exactly what he had. It was either bipolar or schizophrenia. Mm-hmm. I feel like it was on both sides of the family. One of us was going to get it. So that person was me.
And so you're in this space and you've now had your second sort of, you call it a blip. For me, I think any depression is just hard. So And then you've gone on a slightly higher medication. And then what then led you to your second manic episode? And what do you remember being kind of the build up to that for you?
So between the sort of second blip versus the manic episode was probably a good few years. And mm-hmm. there was a lot of medication changes within that. And mm-hmm. that was, so when I was diagnosed, that the mood stabilizer they put me on was Depakote or sodium valproate, which you mm-hmm. can't have kids on. And they did ask me and state that very clearly, you can't have children on this medication. Are you planning on, you know, falling pregnant anytime soon? And I was 29, so no. Mm-hmm. And actually, it was a medication that worked for me, but I was also quite angry because it meant that it delayed my opportunity at trying for a baby, because I had to go through, I went to a Bipolar UK conference, a talk on that. So I had Professor Ian Jones mm-hmm. and I can't remember the lady's name from Bipolar UK, and they were brilliant. And so from that, we then saw a perinatal specialist, and then we did this long planned change and transition of medication. So I went from sodium valproate to olanzapine. And then I was on olanzapine we were trying for a baby. Loads of people would come visit. We were on holiday. My parents were over. Like, it was this big culmination of things that then led me into, and then also the being unwell, which was probably because I was burning the candle at both ends. So it's hard to know exactly where that second episode started, but I do feel like it probably had a good 3 or 4 months build up because of all the socializing. And then the kind of pinnacle was where I sort of realized that I was manic, is I had this one quite extreme day while we were on holiday. We were watching the Cricket World Cup, which we had 2 Kiwis and 2 Brits in the rooms. It was very tense. And then I was also trying to watch the Wimbledon final, and all this stuff happened. And then unfortunately we had news that there was a death in the family. And in my head, I recognized I had some unrealistic thoughts. But because of those thoughts, I triggered, like, right, we've got this to do in a month. And I had plotted every day for the next month to make a major life change. And I was like, that's extreme. And actually, I probably need to be seen.
Mm. Yeah. So you recognized what was happening and you decided to take yourself to your doctor and say, this is what's going on.
Yeah, so I'd been told previously by a psychiatrist that if I did come into felt like I was going manic, just to double my medication and then seek help. So I started doing that, and we were on holiday, so I saw an on-call GP mm-hmm. Who gave me, because of the chest infection, gave me some antibiotics, which ended up curing that, which was great. So which meant that I could sleep because I wasn't coughing and keeping myself up all night. But then I had my first episode, because it was so extreme and it was my first, I had all the support. I had all the teams. I was seen by people for at least 2 years after. I feel like if you are first diagnosed, you get loads of support. But I feel like there's this, once you've been diagnosed and once you've come through your first episode, you should know how to deal with it. That's my kind of feeling. I went through out of hours GPs, 2-3 A&E visits before they would get me seen by a team, and then they refused to do anything about my medication until I kind of kicked off and sort of said, it's not working, like, I need to try something new, which is when they swapped me over to quetiapine. So okay. And I know that in your talk with Simon from Bipolar UK, the talk around having a regular psychiatrist, that's never been a thing for me. Mm. I'm only seen in the moment, or I'm only seen when I'm unwell. Mm. And even if I want to kind of have a review, you know, it's months mm-hmm. before you can get seen. And I'm amazed, and I'm on a few Facebook groups of people with bipolar, and I'm amazed that some people have regular psychiatric assessments or care, and I'm that's just never been available to me. So in my head, if you want something urgent, you go private. Mm-hmm. Or you are at A&E and they deem you unwell enough to be part of the, you know, referred to the crisis team.
Mm-hmm. It's so inconsistent, isn't it? And, you know, I remember before I got my diagnosis, I think I waited 6-7 months to be seen by a psychiatrist. And in that time, I had a full-blown manic episode, and I was managing that myself at home, you know, causing chaos. But they didn't have time to see me. Truth is, if they'd seen me, I probably would have been heavily medicated or hospitalized, you know, for my own safety and the safety of others around me. I certainly wouldn't have been allowed to drive, you know, but I was because I hadn't been diagnosed and no one was seeing me, right? And I felt like for me in the UK, it was all the time I was still showing instability, signs of instability, I was kept under care. And then when I became stable, I got discharged to the GP. And I suppose in your situation where you are dealing with these very acute but very sporadic periods of being unwell, that leaves you quite vulnerable, really, because guess what? You're stable, discharged. But where's the middle bit for someone like you? That model doesn't work for someone like you.
No. I think, I don't know if you've ever heard of a recovery college. There's a few across the UK and that they were my saving grace in my second episode. I wasn't getting seen properly. People were not taking me seriously, trying to find alternative things wrong. Like they were flirting with the idea of borderline personality disorder, which upon reflection is not appropriate for me. Mm-hmm. And so I found out about the recovery college, and they do co-produce. So you've got someone that's employed in the NHS and someone who's lived experience presenting courses on either different conditions or anxiety management, coping skills, strategies, self-care. And I just threw myself into the learning. And it was a really safe kind of community environment. And I really valued that a lot. And I use that a lot in my day-to-day in terms of all the skills and the toolkit that you arm yourself with, which is obviously really important.
Yeah, essential. These skills to stay well are critical. And, you know, it's so easy to get into that tug of war space where either way, going high or low, you can see things coming and we don't necessarily, we sort of disassociate from them. You know, that can happen a lot, right? And all of these skills help us to not do that and help us to kind of advocate for ourselves. And it's still a battle and it's still a tug of war to do so, right? It's hard work. Like, honestly, I was talking to a lady last night about this, and we were saying it's like you've got your job and you've got bipolar, and both are full-time jobs. And we were saying, you know, even after like a conversation, you'll like inspect everything you do afterwards, like quick time. It's like you do like a quick review of every meeting, every conversation. Was that okay? Was it balanced enough? Oh, was it a bit too much? Am I okay? Like, you know, and it's this constant sort of self-inspection of, am I well?
Yeah.
Which is exhausting.
It is exhausting. And I feel like it's almost unfair, particularly like I feel a little bit like, oh, it's not fair, because when I'm feeling good and I'm feeling productive and I'm doing well, that's when I have to analyze myself and be like, oh, is this? And that's almost like taking away from the good stuff that's happening. Yes. But it's also things I like to do a mood diary every night. I do it like a paper one. That's just how it works for me. I've tried some of the some of the apps. It's not for me. But, you know, I analyze whether I'm anxious or stressed. I analyze how physically active I've been. How robust are my relationships? How have my mood been on the, you know, the 1 to 10 scale and 5 obviously being flat, which is great. Well, that's my, you know, 0 to 10 kind of one. And then just sort of an overall. And then I write down anything that's like, did I burst into tears for no reason? Did I get really violently angry at someone for, you know, nothing, that, you know, out of perspective? And and it is exhausting having to constantly monitor. And then, is it okay if I have an actual coffee because they've run out of decaf? or, you know, I do think having gotten better and being really stable at the moment, I do dabble a little bit when I know that I probably shouldn't. So I'll have a few nights out. It's for me, it's the sleep rather than the alcohol that's the impact. So like I'll have a night out, but then I'll be at home for 2 days to kind of make sure I get better sleep straight afterwards. Or you know, if I have a caffeinated coffee on the odd occasion, it's kind of okay. But as a rule, I try and be herbal tea or decaf. And yeah, it is a constant watching and being like, oh, was that appropriate? Or, you know,
and that is, I suppose, a big difference. So, for example, for somebody that lives with depression and depression alone, when they come out of that depression, it's just a celebration, right? It's like, and if they have a really good day, it's like a super celebration. Now, if someone with bipolar has a really good day, it's like, oh,
Is that a warning?
That's good, but, right? That's good, but, you know, I get little messages from my friends and they're like, how are you? Too busy at the moment? Busy? How busy are we right now? I'm like, so frustrating. And it's lovely, you know, that people are looking out for you and all of those things. And it's impossible, right? If it's hard for us, it must be hard for people around us. I know it is. So, you know, it's like, are we too busy? Oh, God. So, yeah, I get it. That bit's hard.
Yeah.
So you are stable now and have been stable for?
Coming up 2 years.
Okay.
So I went back to work in December 2019 and had sort of a couple of months of phased return. Mm-hmm. And then I was back full time about 6 or 7 weeks when COVID hit. Mm-hmm. And so I've been stable since Christmas 2019. So mm-hmm. coming up 2 years.
And how much time did you give yourself to recover the second time versus the first time? Because I noticed that you said you were more mindful of that.
Yes. So the first time I was off work for 9 weeks and went back. And I do have to get, my boss was an absolute hero. We learned to work together in a different way because we knew it was work related. And we learned to work so much more efficiently. And through that, I had really strict boundaries with work in terms of taking breaks and working my hours and not mm-hmm. over that as mm-hmm. as best as I can. Obviously, occasionally you need to put in a few extra hard yards, but mm-hmm. I was really protective around my work time and my personal time. Mm-hmm. But that was only 9 weeks. And then my second episode, I probably could have gone back to work maybe a month sooner than I did, but I had 5 months off work. Mm-hmm. So I'd gone through work's kind of sick pay, which is, you know, paying mm-hmm. you at full pay for a certain period. And then I was on statutory, which was, I think it was like 94 quid a week or something. Mm-hmm. So I was almost dipping into the savings to live, but to justify taking the time for me, because I knew it was really important to make sure I was really, really well before I went back. And I am glad I did it. And I know it sounds scary being out of the business for 5 months, but hopefully if that only happens once in every 10 years, if at all, you know, obviously, hopefully every time you learn more and you know, and put more self-care strategies in place to prevent future mm-hmm. illness. But mm-hmm. if that was a one-off, then that's not a bad thing.
No, and the most important thing is your health, right? And long or longer periods of stability wherever we can get them. And I heard you say that you were sort of, you know, trying different kind of medications and different combinations, and now are you on something that you feel is kind of like your staple and that's working for you and that's something you're committed with, or where are you at with that, with meds?
So I went from sodium valproate, came that off entirely, started dialing it back up when I had blips, just sort of nudging it up the medication. And then obviously went through the whole, if we want to try for a baby, we need to change, went on to olanzapine because that had been one of the stopgates they used when I was unwell in 2012. And then I felt like that wasn't working. So they swapped me to quetiapine, and it's been okay. Going on to quetiapine, I had a month worth of really severe reactions and what's the word, you know, like responses to mm-hmm. the medication, night sweats, night terrors, mm-hmm. you know, flu symptoms, like all sorts of horrendousness. But then after I sort of rode that storm for a month, it's been fine. Mm-hmm. I think for now it's fine. I wouldn't be adverse to, you know, if it doesn't work or potentially trying something different in the future. Mm-hmm. I mean, as a woman of childbearing age, it doesn't make sense to not be on something that is deemed relatively mm-hmm. okay for mm-hmm. that process, should that, you know, be in my future. I did feel like I worked really well with sodium valproate, but mm-hmm. that's not appropriate for mm-hmm. for the life stage I'm at the moment.
Yeah. I hear you on that. Different medications, different reasons. You know, I feel like I've had to make serious compromises with my ideal staple meds that I know just work for me. And I've had to compromise on those in the period, you know, the season of life that I'm in right now, which is just crappy, isn't it? that, what can we do? You can only make the best choices out of the ones that are available to us, right?
Very true.
Sometimes we don't really want any of them, but we have to pick the best one to serve us in the season that we're in. And that's literally all we can do. So yeah, I just hear you on that point. And before we kind of finish, I would love you to share, because I know that you've done some work with Bipolar UK as well. And can you share with us the work that you're doing, because you have a keen interest in making an impact in workplaces and raising awareness. Tell us about that side of what you're doing.
Oh, brilliant. Yeah. So I think it started with Bipolar UK. I was, for a period of time, I was a media and an employment ambassador. So the media ambassador was being on their list. And if any journalist came up and wanted to do a story, they would sort of ask the appropriate people that had the relevant experience. And through that, I got to do like a big, big splash in a Sunday paper magazine. I had a photo shoot and everything and an interview, and that was all really fun and quite cool. And then I've had lots of blogs published or different parts of my story published in different places over the years. And the employment ambassador thing was brilliant because they would go in to do workplace training to explain what bipolar is and how it might manifest, or how an employee or a colleague or a client might present themselves. And then what people, you know, what things help and work in that space. And then I would sort of be drawn on for my lived experience and what that was like. Through my second episode in particular, I felt that I learned like enough skills and I came back to work feeling really robust and refreshed. And I've done in the past and since a really good couple of presentations to my workplace. And now that everything's on online, it's much easier to engage the entire country. So the employer I work for has about 2,000 people. So we can be, you know, we can do these presentations and it can get a lot of coverage and record them and that kind of thing. So I've done about bipolar and sharing mine and a colleague's experiences, and then kind of what that might look like to someone else that's looking in from the outside, and then sort of things that we do to kind of stay well. I've done that with other organizations outside of my work, but in particular we have I work with what we call our diversity and inclusion forum. So I'm part of that, representing the Enable team, which is our disability and mental health pillar. And we've done a lot of awareness pieces and trying to change policy within our company. But outside of that, they put me forward for industry talks. So when there was industry panels wanting to discuss disability in the media or working with disability in the media, so I would be there representing the mental health side of the disability part. And then we also did an industry panel for the all-party parliamentary groups. Both the disability one and the media one came together to talk about representation of disability in the media. So being able to represent my company and represent sort of mental health in those spaces has been really, really rewarding. And I get a lot of great feedback from all the talks that I have been fortunate enough to do. So it feels like it really ticks a really deep box for me, you know, like quite a soulful kind of, I feel like I'm, you know, slowly making a difference in each of those occasions, which is really rewarding.
Yeah, the work you're doing is really, really important, because I think especially in workplace settings, this condition is deeply misunderstood and highly stigmatized, and people are very fearful about being truthful about their condition in these spaces, which I just think adds to the shame, adds to the pressure, adds to the stress, adds to the triggers, adds to being unwell. So what you're doing is super important, and yeah, you know, being able to give back in these spaces is amazing, right? And you know, if you can find a space that you can give back in that's passionate for you, it's super rewarding. So I love what you're doing and I've loved talking to you today. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's been lovely. And what are you doing for the rest of the day in England?
Work. Yeah. Start now. So yeah, throw myself back into that. But it's a lovely blue sky today as well, so I'll make sure I get out and get some fresh air.
Good. I was about to ask you the weather question, because how did I not? What's the weather like today? Well, I'm happy you've got blue skies. So thank you very much for today.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of Let's Talk Bipolar, the podcast brought to you by Bipolar UK. Please go to our website, www.bipolaruk.org, for all of our resources and all of the support that we can offer you.